in alphabetical order. Car Talk, Midnight Special, Prairie Home Companion, This American Life. At AM 580, we understand the value of a good story and a hearty laugh. So join the friends of WILL during our membership drive next week and help ensure the future of this community resource.
Good morning and welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal, and Henry Frayne is at the controls. In this part of Focus, we will be dipping into the history of science, and our guest for the program is Brian Burrell. He is an instructor in mathematics at University of Massachusetts at Amherst and is author of a book that we'll be talking about this morning that looks back to a time when, and here we're talking about mid-19th century, when many prominent leading intellectuals willed their brains to science. And these brains, along with the brains of some notorious criminals, were collected. They were collected and they were studied by anatomists and researchers and scientists, cut up, examined, looking for the biological basis of both genius and depravity. Now, eventually, the project was abandoned, at least in this fashion, because it didn't really yield much in the way of new information, and science went on to other ways of trying to ask that question. But the brains that were collected still exist many places around the world. Our guest, Brian Burrell, has visited some of these collections, and this morning we'll be talking about this chapter of scientific history, The Search for Good and Evil in the Physical Anatomy of the Brain. It's the subject of his new book that's titled Postcards from the Brain Museum, and it's published by Broadway Books. Should be out now or very soon in a bookstore near you. Questions are certainly welcome. The telephone number here on our program is 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, and toll-free 800-222-WILL. Those are the numbers. Mr. Burrell, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us.
My pleasure.
You begin the book with something that I think probably people can relate to, a story about a movie. This was the first film version of Frankenstein. And people may remember, certainly people know the story of the doctor who goes and takes pieces of dead bodies and sticks them together with the idea that he's going to reanimate them. So the assistant is sent out because, they have to have a brain. And he is sent out to steal the brain of a famous scientist. But he's spooked in the laboratory there at night where he's trying to steal the brain. He drops it on the floor. So he grabs the next one that he can get his hands on. And, of course, this is the brain of a notorious criminal. And as you tell the story that actually this was something that the director of the movie said, well, we've got to put something in here because we've got to somehow explain why it is that the creature is bad. And the explanation is, well, bad creature, bad brain. And you make the argument that not only did that perhaps reflect what a lot of people thought, maybe what was a common understanding, but that indeed helped shape the understanding that people had about, you know, why some people were geniuses and were benevolent and why some people were very bad.
Yes, that's right. Actually, on a more comical note, the reason I started the book with that particular anecdote is that whenever I mentioned to people what I was writing a book about, a lot of people would immediately ask me if I was going to include Abby Normal in the book.
I must confess, I thought about the same thing.
Yeah, and just for listeners who don't know the reference, this is to Mel Brooks's Young Frankenstein. And the same scene is reenacted, the dropping, well, there are the two brains on display, the brain, the normal brain, and the brain of a depraved criminal. Marty Feldman announces to Frankenstein when he comes back that the brain he picked up, you know, belonged to Abby somebody. And I was interested to find, looking back at the history of that scene, that, yes, it was invented for that, the 1931 version of Frankenstein. Not, by the way, the first film version. The first was by Edison, actually, a silent version. But what comes before that is a lecture in the medical college, a demonstration of these two brains. So this is what precedes the brain dropping, is this explanation by the professor that you can look at these two brains and you can tell which one belongs to the criminal by just tracing the fissures, the pattern of fissures on its surface, and its general structure. And so that is an idea that has stuck with a lot of people because of that film, that you can actually tell this, that without the label on the jar, perhaps you could say that this is the brain of a criminal. So I thought it was a nice jumping-off point for the book.
And what sort of makes the movie, the Mel Brooks movie, funnier is that it's actually quite a close parody of these movies that were made in the 30s. So a lot of what happens in those movies, he has stolen directly from those from the old movies.
Exactly, and actually, the point I make is that the original Frankenstein, or I should say the famous one, the Boris Karloff version, that brain-dropping scene was actually stolen, in a sense, or at least inspired by a bit of earlier history, because this lecture on the structure of the criminal brain, this came from the literature of criminal anthropology of that era and of, say, the previous 40 or 50 years. And even the brain-dropping itself, and this here is a bit more conjectural, but this might have been inspired by a pretty famous story about the dropping of Walt Whitman's brain. The brain of Walt Whitman was collected upon his death in 1892, and the story goes that it was to be preserved and shelved for future study with as part of a brain collection in Philadelphia, but that somewhere along the line, a careless laboratory assistant dropped it, and it smashed to pieces, and they swept it up and threw it away. So it was very interesting to find out this lineage from this history of elite brain studies leading to Frankenstein and, of course, eventually leading to Mel Brooks.
Mm-hmm. Well, and again, I guess the important point is that this idea, the very idea that in the physical structure of the brain, somehow there resided genius and good or depravity and evil, and that it was something that you should actually be able to see. That is, that they had this idea that if you indeed took the brain of Walt Whitman or Albert Einstein or anybody you could mention like that, and set it aside, say, you know, you could go out and get the brain of some terrible serial murderer, you could set the two side by side and that there would be some visible difference which would explain the personalities and the behaviors of the two individuals, that there is this idea that in this thing that you can hold in your hand, this mass of tissue, somewhere in there, even though the person is gone, you can find the explanation for who they were.
It's a compelling idea, isn't it, when you think about it? Because if you do look at a brain, its surface, of course, has this characteristic pattern, and while all brains are different in their patterns, just like fingerprints, there's a certain general structure to it. But this idea that if we all have fingerprints and these are all unique to us, then we also all have these patterns in the surface of the brain or in its general structure that are unique to us. And it seems at least a logical point of investigation to say, okay, let's just see if there's anything to this. And that's what you get when this first started around 1850. Basically, it started then because techniques for preserving brains did not really come along until the early 1800s, so it was a very difficult object to look at and study. But it seemed like a perfectly reasonable conjecture. Here's this thing that has so much complexity of structure. Why not try to look for patterns in it? And so that's what they did. People started donating brains or collecting them from unwilling suspects and looking to see if there was anything consistent in the brains of eminent professors in the brains of criminals in terms of structures, size, proportion, weight, and so on. So at least initially, it was a legitimate scientific investigation. This is what scientists do. They look for patterns, correlations, try to see if they mean anything. The problem, of course, is it's one thing to take the brain of an Einstein and look at it and say, well, there's something very distinctive about this brain. But if you flip it around and you are handed a brain that doesn't have the name attached to it, or if you see a row of such brains and you're asked to pick out the Einstein, it turns out that no one's been able to do this.
I'm sure that going back a long time in human history, people were aware of what the contents of the skull was, that there was something in there, and what it was and what it looked like. But apparently, for a long time, there was no real consensus on what the brain did or just how important it was. At what point did scientists really... was there a sort of critical mass of scientists who were saying, well, this structure, we really think that it really is important and it does have something to do with thinking and behavior?
The key point there is this idea of critical mass, because even going back to the time of Hippocrates, there were thinkers who looked at the human body and said, the brain is where all thinking, all feeling, memory, imagination goes on. But then you had other thinkers, and fairly dominating ones like Aristotle, who just thought that the brain was a cooling device for the blood and that the heart was actually the organ of thought. So as you go through history and read medical writers, philosophers, and others, you get this back and forth discussion. There are some who believe that other organs, the heart, the liver, and so on, were responsible for producing thoughts or at least emotions. And this influence of Aristotle lasted a long time, in fact, through the 1700s. So that wasn't really until around the year 1800 that the critical mass, I think, was reached, and it was decided that, yes, the brain is the organ of the mind. It is the organ that produces all these thoughts and feelings. So while you can go back to, and you can cite certain anatomists and even philosophers, Descartes, for example, who gave the brain primary importance, it really did not become the consensus until the very early 1800s, when anatomists finally let go of this idea that the liver or the spleen or the heart had something to do with it. Now, another issue, of course, that this raises, and Descartes is the one who's famous for raising this issue, is in the relation of the brain to the mind, the physical brain to the actual mind or soul, whether these things are one and the same, or as Descartes proposed, that the soul has a separate existence, a non-physical existence, and it basically has a portal that allows it access to the physical brain, which is otherwise just a machine. So as you can see, it gets fairly complicated. But yeah, this idea of the brain as the organ of the mind, this is actually attributed to Franz Joseph Gall. At least he didn't invent the idea, but he's the one who popularized it by essentially inventing phrenology.
Well, we'll talk about Gall in a moment. I have a caller here I want to get to, and also I would like to introduce again the guest for anyone who might have tuned in the last few minutes, Brian Borrell. He's the author of the book Postcards from the Brain Museum. The subtitle is The Improbable Search for Meaning in the Matter of Famous Minds. It's published by Broadway Books and does take a look at this period of science when there were anatomists and researchers that were collecting brains and looking at them and studying them and dissecting them and trying to understand why it is that one person was a genius and one person might be a criminal, and felt that somehow in the structure of the brain the answer would lie. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We have a caller in Indiana to talk with on our line 4, toll free line. Hello.
Hello. A couple anecdotes. I remember when I first read Aristotle and his position that everything was going on in the heart, is intuitively I never could buy that, because when I sat in my chair, my thoughts and stuff and that kind of feeling, it was in my head. I never have understood why they went after the liver and the heart and all the other proto things they could find before Gall got it popularized. Secondly, if I remember correctly, they examined Einstein's brain. And if I remember correctly, all they said is that the possible thing that was different from his brain and from others, and they didn't give any statistics or where it fit in anything, is that he had more, we'll call them crevices or cauliflower shapes or whatever. And third question is, this is sort of off the subject, but since your lecture in mathematics at Amherst there, I've sort of lost contact with a lot of those things. I was just wondering, if you're going after your doctorates or already have it, what's sort of the fashionable thing now in mathematics for graduate students, to take your degree in? Thanks a lot.
Okay. Well, three questions. I just to comment on the Aristotle business. I think one of the explanations is that certainly emotions, which are most often in those, in the old days attributed to organs in the chest, basically. Well, emotions tend to be felt in the chest, and I think this was an overriding concern. And, of course, the heart has always been, especially in religious terms, a particularly important organ. And hearts were preserved essentially before brains were, and usually were accorded a separate burial, or sometimes they were preserved as sacred relics. Now, this brings us to Einstein, whose brain was preserved as kind of a sacred relic, and it is true, it was studied. A few studies were published, most notably in 1999, showing some distinctive structures in Einstein's brain. And it is true, these are only conjectures. There are suggestions that this might have some significance, with possible explanations of what the significance is. And this is based on localization of brain function. The problem there, of course, is that everyone's brain is unique, so that any brain you study, you're going to find something distinctive about it. And then attaching meaning, it's all plausible, and you can make such suggestions, but proving them, or doing it the other way around, as I said before, without the labels distinguishing which is the genius brain and which is the criminal brain, that's still the trick. Now, as to mathematics, that's probably the one question that is most difficult to handle. I mean, lately, in teaching statistics, which actually is the part of mathematics that is most relevant to this book, I've been working with a lot of statistics graduate students, and this seems to be a pretty good field to go into these days. But it's otherwise kind of hard to make a general answer to that question as to what's hot and what's not in mathematics.
All right. Well, let's talk with someone else. So we'll have someone here in Urbana where we are, line one. Hello.
Yeah, hello. I think I in general think that all this attention to brain and cognitive sciences and everything is a little silly, but I have a hard time explaining why. But when you were talking about collecting those brains before, and you said it was a it was logical, I agree, it's certainly logical. And the thing that came to my mind immediately, which I just realized I've never heard anybody talk about, is whether or not, as I understood it, the brain has is made up of portions that are resemble more primitive animals, and that there's a kind of like a succession of development that you can see in the brain, and I hadn't thought of it before, but I would think that you could that the relative proportions devoted to each level would signify something, and I was just curious if anybody had looked into that in relation to this gathering of brains you were talking about.
Yes, absolutely. In fact, this is a field, comparative anatomy is a field in which, at least in the comparative anatomy of the brain, the idea is to study the brains of, say, all mammals and look at them on an evolutionary scale. And of course, you see great resemblances right up through the primates. This was, by the way, a good excuse for preserving brains, especially back in the 1850s when this line of investigation began, because by comparing behavior of animals and man, you can draw some conclusions. And of course, a lot of legitimate brain research about the function and structure of the brain and how it localizes the five senses, motor control. These experiments are first done on animals. So it's logical, I should actually say, preserving brains for study and dissecting them is logical for many reasons. And of course, there are still brain banks and legitimate reasons for studying brain pathology, the effects of Alzheimer's, strokes, injuries, and so on. So that's one field of investigation. Of course, I'm talking about something different, and it's interesting that you would bring that up, because in the 1850s, the researchers who were doing the breakthrough work in this field were preserving and studying the brains of primates, reptiles, and comparing their parts, essentially, the systems, size in particular, complexity, and trying to make some determination about, the evolutionary structure of the brain. All of this is very legitimate field of research, but of course it also leads to this idea that if you can compare, for example, dogs and cats to apes and apes to men and women, you begin to break things down even further. And this led into some dangerous ground in comparing men to women or comparing the different races and seeing if you could detect some sort of evolutionary divisions, say, that you see between species. So this was tried for a while. Conjectures were made. They were discredited, but many of them caused an awful lot of damage, especially in terms of scientific racism, which actually got its start in a lot of this kind of work.
Hmm. Yeah, but you're not... are you saying that there was no... I take your point. I guess you're saying that even in cases where the cortex of the brain, or what is it, the cerebellum?
The cerebral cortex is the focus of this. The cerebellum has its own cortex, and the cortex is the outer layer of cells, essentially the neurons, the thinking cells, basically.
Yeah, are you saying that where that takes a larger relative space, for example, that it would be dangerous to take the next step and then say that these people are more evolved, because that would start putting a hierarchy to, that where one person would one group would feel justified in feeling superior, and therefore Nazism would evolve and that kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that, in fact, is what happened in the initial stages of this. Some of it was just based on some bad technique, because measuring brains is a very difficult business. But they got into weighing brains, trying to figure out the surface area of the cerebral cortex, that's of the cerebral hemispheres, and trying to make the most obvious conjecture, the first one, is that size matters, the size of the brain is somehow in direct correlation with thinking power or capacity. But when you think about it, this gets to be kind of a slippery slope because, okay, the brains of men on average are larger than those of women. Of course, the brains of blue whales are a lot bigger than the brains of men. So the argument begins to break down. when you go into all these measurements, brain size versus body mass, for example, the field mouse outdoes humans. It was dangerous ground, and of course, all sorts of conjectures were made and later disproven. But it did try to feed into stereotypes. Really, the whole book is about preconceptions. When preconceptions enter the field of science, some bad things can happen.
Something else I was thinking of is when the whole idea of say with computers, you have the hardware and you have the software, and it would be logical to think that if your chipset is of a certain type, it would only be capable of so much, and regardless of what the software was, but without that software in the first place, you're really not going to do anything, regardless of the chipset. So I imagine you get that kind of, you start thinking along those lines, too, when you start studying brains and accomplishment.
Yeah, it's always been a tempting analogy, this one, between computers and brains. Although, if you think about it, really, with computers, the goal over time is always miniaturization. So it tends to work in the opposite direction. Things get smaller, and they get more powerful. The software-hardware analogy, though, it tends to be a little too simplistic to apply to the brain and mind. And so, but again, basically a lot of these arguments, the arguments for the importance of brain size or fissural complexity or the prominence of the frontal lobes, these arguments all rested on analogies like this, which tended really not to be very scientific, but they're compelling. People are drawn towards these types of things.
Well, just for a second to stay with this this controversy over whether size matters, that for a while people did have this idea, and perhaps that's understandable on a kind of a not terribly deep level, that if the brain is all about thinking, that if one brain is bigger, then somehow that means that maybe we think that person is smarter. How many brains did they have to look at before they got away from the idea? And here, just comparing one human being to another, got away somehow from the idea that a really brilliant person, well, somehow their brain must be bigger than someone who is not so brilliant.
Well, ultimately thousands. But what we're talking about here is a period from about 1855 to about 1905. And during that half century, a lot of brains were being collected, and this brain weight theory held sway for most of that time. It was a general conjecture, the idea being that there's not a strict relationship, but generally speaking, smarter people have bigger brains. As they began to collect more and more brains, however, some problems arose with this theory, which is to say the data didn't really support it. So that, for example, they began to find in criminal brains, of which many were studied, criminal brains were pretty easy to get, and so there were some very large studies of criminal brains, and they turned out to be bigger on average than brains of eminent professors, scientists, and writers. That was one thing. Then you have embarrassing exceptions. So you have Ivan Turgenev, the Russian novelist, brain was huge, over 2,000 grams, the average being about 1,400. And then you have the writer Anatole France, whose brain was about half that size. And for that matter, you have Einstein, whose brain was well below average in size. So as you begin to encounter these exceptions, truly brilliant people with unexceptional brains, the theory begins to suffer. And in fact, it almost gets somewhat humorous at a point when a French brain donation society began collecting the brains of their fellow members. And some of them turned out to be embarrassingly small. And at first they tried to hide this. They tried to hide the data. And eventually they just had to abandon this theory. Because how else could they explain some of their most brilliant colleagues and friends having very small brains. So, yeah, but even so, I think this idea still exists in the popular consciousness. And it's not just, well, if you read the Sherlock Holmes novels, for example, you always see this reference to someone who has a big protruding forehead as being, having to be, you know, the deduction is this has to be a high intellect. So the notion is still alive, but not so much among brain scientists.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Brian Burrell. If you're interested in reading this story, you can look for his book. It's just recently come out. It's titled Postcards from the Brain Museum. It's published by Broadway Books. Brian Burrell's a lecturer in mathematics at University of Massachusetts at Amherst, also the author of The Words We Live By and Damn the Torpedoes. He's appeared on a couple programs here to talk about his work, Book Notes on C-SPAN, also today. And he's joining us this morning by telephone. And certainly if you're interested in reading the book, Postcards from the Brain Museum, head out to the bookstore. Questions, too, here are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. A little earlier, I'd said that maybe we should talk about Gall and about phrenology.
Yes.
Now, an idea that sort of seems laughable, and yet there was a time when some people thought there was something to it. That was the idea that by looking at the physical features of the skull on the outside, literally the bumps on people's heads, you could tell something significant about them.
Yes, and Gall actually has gotten kind of a bum rap about all this, although I should say he set himself up for it. His original contention, other than the idea that the brain is the organ of the mind, is that the brain divides up the labor. This actually was a scandalous idea. Most anatomists and physiologists at the time just believed the brain was one single organ that was responsible for thinking, for directing the body, at least those who at the time adopted the brain as mind theory as opposed to the, you know, liver or heart as mind. But Gall did have this suggestion that different regions of the brain control different things or are responsible for different behaviors. And he set out to study this. The problem for Gall when he began is he wasn't much of an anatomist initially. He eventually became one. But that there were no means for preserving brains for very long. They couldn't be preserved permanently. Formaldehyde wasn't discovered till the late 1800s. And so he decided to focus on the skull and the contours of the skull in the belief that they reflected the contours of the brain. Now, this happened to be just a sort of a side conjecture for him. He thought it was worth looking into. And so he did start collecting plaster busts and feeling people's heads, but he didn't do it for money. And he didn't think he could just take the man on the street and tell him something about himself just by feeling his skull. His idea was to take extraordinary people and, again, see if there was some pattern to their head, their skull structure. It was his partner, Caspar Schwertzheim, who turned this into a kind of self-discovery and self-help philosophy as opposed to a, you know, physiology of the mind. Of course, many years later, anatomists finally revealed that the shape of the skull doesn't really have all that much to do with the shape of the brain. There can be a considerable disparity. It also turned out, rather comically for Gall's detractors, that his own skull turned out to be incredibly thick and his brain somewhat small, which they thought was very amusing. But Gall was right about some things. He was right about the localization of brain function. It was just kind of hard to assign regions, as the phrenologists essentially did, for various qualities of mind, like love of children or destructiveness or murderousness or whatever. So it eventually got out of hand and completely discredited. But Gall himself did a lot of good work in anatomy, and he does get credit for popularizing this idea of, well, two things. The brain is the organ of the mind, and the localization of brain function. It's just that eventually the study had to turn to brains instead of skulls because, the skull wasn't really leading anywhere.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk with another caller. We have someone listening in Champaign. Line one. Hello.
Hello. Yeah. This may be completely off the subject, but I thought I would ask it anyway, since obviously it's talking about anatomy of the brain. Is there, because of brain chemistry, do people's diets, is there anything that you could certainly eat on a fairly regular basis that might help spark those neurons and keep the brain chemistry healthy? And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Okay. This is the funny thing about when you talk about brains, is that almost anything is relevant, actually. Nothing is really off the track. It opens up all kinds of avenues. And this initially it might sound like, okay, brains and diet. Well, one of the things that one of these brain scientists noted in a study of brains of professors in the 1920s, is that nourishment has a lot to do with brain growth, which is to say the size of the brain does correlate with body size. This is why men's brains tend to be about 15% on average larger than women's. It's because men's are taller than women and about 15% bigger on average. So we're talking about height more than weight. And so it turns out that nourishment actually is very important. Now, I can't speak to specifics of diet, but one of the things that this scientist discovered in examining actually the brains of a few of his learned colleagues, and he remarked that the brain seemed to be well nourished, which is to say blood vessels in good condition, tissue in good condition. And, of course, this is well established. Good diet has everything to do with growth of the body, during the growth periods. And, of course, the brain is growing mostly from up until the teenage years are the periods of the greatest growth. And, in fact, from your 20s onward, the brain tends to diminish slightly in size. You begin to lose neurons. And the tissue weakens. So nourishment certainly has a lot to do with it. In adulthood, of course, I think the idea would just be to stay healthy. In childhood, it's essential. Nourishment is essential not just to the growing of the body, but to the growth of the brain itself. And in fact, there have been these recent studies, I think, in the news just yesterday about teens and reckless driving. And they're showing that there are certain parts of the brain that don't mature fully until your early 20s. So again, I can't speak specifically about, what foods might, whether fish, for example, is a brain food. I don't know if that's been established. I think it has been established that just an all-around balanced diet is a good thing for your brain, if not for everything else.
All right, let's talk with someone else. In Belgium, nearby community, line four. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. In your discussion, you've been discussing intellect and, evilness, I guess you'd say, between these two different groups of people. And you have mentioned animals occasionally. And the question I have for you, and I don't know if it fit completely, but it's along this line. We know how intelligent we seem to be. And we seem to think we know how intelligent other animals are. But how do you know, in a case of something like a whale or a dolphin or something that we really don't have much contact with, how intelligent they really are? They could very well be more intelligent than us, but they just don't write books.
This is a good point. Earlier I did make the comment about the whale brain, which stuck in my mind because I saw a whale brain in one of these museums, which looks rather impressive. Yes, assessments of intelligence, it's a tricky subject, and in fact, a lot of these assessments have focused on the faculty of speech. In fact, this is one of the first things that was investigated because this is the distinctive thing about humans is the capacity for speech.
Now, don't whales have a vocabulary?
Well, we think they do. And, yeah, I have to admit, I can't speak all that in all that informed a way about whales, dolphins, for example. There certainly is communication between animals. But if you look at it from a historical point of view, and I'm thinking mainly of these scientists, anatomists and anthropologists in, say, the mid-1800s, who were not really aware of, for example, communication between whales and dolphins and that sort of thing. So, yeah, it's of course, it's perfectly natural. We study ourselves and we think of ourselves as being on the top of the scale. And, yeah, I can't really say whether we can properly assess the intelligence of other species. Certainly in brain anatomical terms, the whole investigation is based on complexity of structure. But there again, you know, this is the problem in investigating the structure of human brains, is knowing exactly what that structure is, what it controls. So I think it's a valid point to raise. I can't really answer it in that sense. I can't really say how we know. I can only try to put it in the context of this particular study. And it is a frustrating thing, but it is also an intriguing thing, is to try to look at the structure of something and try to figure out its function. And, you know, I suppose this kind of research is ongoing, but it's a good point.
Yeah, we can take it even simpler. You know, I can correspond with my dog to make him do a lot of things, but we surely can't talk about Nishi. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
you
know, that's true. You know,
see what I'm saying? You know, there is a level of intelligence there, but we really don't have any way of grasping where it's at because we don't have a common medium between us.
Well, not on any absolute level, certainly. And also, every species is different. I mean, you know, for example, this. You know, people look at dogs and cats differently. So how do we assess the relative intelligence between dogs and cats? You know, cats are a very different sort of animal, not as receptive to training. And we look at them and we think of them differently. We impart certain qualities of mind to animals, and we do it differently for different animals. I mean, that's just on a human level, not really on a scientific level. But yes, you know, how it relates to brain structure, I can't really say.
Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you. In the book, you early on in the book, you point out that there are, in fact, no brain museums per se, but there are places where they do have brains, some of them brains of famous individuals, which they keep locked away. They're not generally on display so that anybody walking through can see them. But it does, one wonders what utility there is in saving them. Contemporary brain research does indeed use brains, as you point out, too, and that they're used in studying things like Alzheimer's disease and cancer and so forth. And that's important, particularly if you can have a good medical history of the person that whose brain you're studying. But in some of these cases, with some of these brains that are preserved in jars and have been for a long time and you know, may not be in ideal condition, one wonders how it is that somewhere along the line they weren't thrown away. And now maybe again that tells you something about how we feel about the brain, and it's not like a kidney. Maybe we'd be willing to throw away an old kidney. But the brain somehow, maybe we save some special sort of reverence for that other body parts don't get.
Well, certainly many brains were thrown away or just lost. Walt Whitman is one example. And what I found, what actually fascinated me about all this is that once I found out that these brains once existed as specimens, and I began to look into it, I actually discovered that, yes, these brains do exist, a lot of them, and some very old brains, up to 150 years old. When I talked to the curators of some of these institutions, many of them would say that these brains still exist simply because the investigation was dropped shortly after the outset, and they were just ignored. They were shelved, and people forgot about them. So there were some places I went and asked about brains, and they didn't know they had them. They said, oh, well, we'll take a look, and they actually came up with some of these things. So part of it is just, you know, that we tend to collect things and keep them. We all do in our houses, whatever. There's this reluctance to throw things away. Now, when it's a human brain, of course, you know, this is a very special object. And I was looking at my notes recently, like for this book, and I came across one where I just made this observation that if you had a chance to see Einstein's brain, would you take it? And I think universally everyone would say yes. You know, if you could see Einstein's brain, if someone invited you in, you would go. Now, what would you get out of it? You know, well, you would have seen Einstein's brain.
Be a good story.
Yeah, you would get a good story, and that's exactly it. So the other thing, though, I found in talking to these curators is it's kind of a difficult thing to throw away a brain. Now, there's a collection in Philadelphia on the campus of the University of Pennsylvania, and they actually did try to throw away or actually give away the brains in the 1960s, and no one would take them. They were willing to give them to other museums. They had been willed to the institution, which creates kind of a problem. Someone wills their brain, as many people did to Cornell University, by the way, in you know, about 100 years ago. And they had a sizable collection, but they felt bound to keep these things because people had filled out bequest forms, and they were worried about legal implications. What if they threw them away? Now, they did end up discarding a lot of them, but not the ones that of famous or better-connected people. But when you think about it, if you've got a brain in a jar, and especially if you know whose brain it is, you're going to want to hang on to it because there is this possibility. You think, well, okay, nothing has panned out so far, but what if in the future something does pan out? What if they discover some way of, you know, reading the surface of a brain? Then you'd want to have this thing. Because one thing, you know, in this book, I don't rule out the possibility that someday they might figure it all out or something.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, there's certainly, I mean, now I think there's just kind of a nostalgic affection or a sort of a curatorial disposition. Let's keep these things. They are objects of interest. But who knows? They might prove useful someday.
Well, that's, I guess I like the idea that we can't quite let go. We can't quite let go of the idea that we might look back on these scientists and say, well, that reflected an inadequacy of knowledge at the time. And we could say now that we have at least a little better understanding of the brain and its structure and how it's function, and that somehow having the physical object and being able to look at it maybe is not going to tell us too much. And at the same time, we still say, but, you know, we just can't quite let go of the idea.
Yeah, especially because every now and then there is some kind of breakthrough. And actually one occurred about 2 years ago. I think it was 3 years ago. Hmm. In Germany, there was a study of musicians' brains. These brains were studied in place using scanning technology, but they scanned the structure and found that there does actually seem to be a structural difference, a very specific structural difference in the what's called the acoustic area of the brain, the Heschel gyrus. It's an area in the temporal lobe of the brain that processes sound, and it seems as though musicians actually do have more of this, significantly more, professional musicians, say, as opposed to amateur musicians. Now, you know, this further investigation is needed, but it's an intriguing idea that perhaps there is some basis to this phrenological contention that a larger region of the brain devoted to a certain skill has some significance. So, yeah, it's certainly not a closed book in that sense. You know, there's more to come.
Well, we will have to stop there. It's a fascinating story, and if you'd like to read more about it, you can look for the book we mentioned. It is titled Postcards from the Brain Museum, The Improbable Search for Meaning in the Matter of Famous Minds, published by Broadway Books, by our guest Brian Burrell. He's a lecturer in mathematics at University of Massachusetts at Amherst. And Mr. Burrell, thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
Our show, Focus 580, is made possible in part by a grant from Bodywork Associates this year, celebrating their 23rd anniversary. Bodywork Associates has been providing professional massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. The broadcast also made possible by grants from 10,000 Villages in downtown Champaign and Crossroads Global Handcrafts 428 North Main in Bloomington, offering ground and whole bean coffee purchased from farmers using internationally recognized fair trade standards. And that's about it for us here on Focus 580. We now need to hand things off to Celeste Quinn. We're going to have coverage of the State of the State today.
That's right. Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich delivers his State of the State message at noon, and AM 580 will bring you live coverage. Following the governor's address, Illinois Public Radio will provide live analysis from Republican Senator Dan Rutherford and Democratic House Member Jay Hoffman. That's the State of the State address coming up from Illinois Public Radio here on AM 580. Let's take a look now at what's happening on the Chicago Board of Trade and the Mercantile Exchange. March wheat trading at 290, up 1 3/4. May 298, up 1 1/4. March corn 194 3/4, down 1/2. May 202 3/4, down 1/2. July 210 1/2, unchanged. December 227 3/4, unchanged. March beans 502 1/2, down 2 3/4. May 504 1/2, down 1 3/4. November 524, down 2 1/4. March meal 151.20, down $1. March oil 1886, down 8 cents. March feeder cattle 99.85, down 10. February live cattle 90.72 1/2, that up 2 1/2. February lean hog 71.30, down 32 1/2. And February bellies 87.92 1/2, down the limit, down $3. In the outside markets, March Brent crude oil 43.60, down 41. The CRB 281.15, down 181. The U.S. dollar 84.04, that up 50. The Dow Jones Industrial Average 10,557, that down 40 points. And the S&P 500 11.86, that is down 7 points. Let's take a look at Ed Kieser's forecast for Illinois and Indiana this afternoon. Mostly sunny, highs ranging from 32 in northeastern Indiana to 46 in west central Illinois. Tonight, mostly clear with patchy fog forming, lows ranging from 13 in northeastern Indiana to 28 in west central and southern Illinois. Tomorrow, mostly sunny, highs ranging from 37 in northeastern Indiana to 54 in west central Illinois. This afternoon,